The Honorable, the Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons have any matter of form of business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, I want you to draw nigh and give their attention. For the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court.
All right, thank you very much. Please be seated and good morning to all of you. Glad to have the Fourth Circuit present here for a hearing this morning. And as we go through this, the lawyers know and you should know we'll use all of the procedures and practices that we use at the Fourth Circuit. Of course, pleased to have Judge Duncan and Judge Agee join us here at the law school this morning. We'll have a chance to say more about them in a bit. But we're ready for argument in the first case, which is Hensley versus Price. Mr. Flanagan.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court, I think I've reserved 5 minutes.
You have, rebuttal. You have.
And I would like to just tell you, the court, who I have with me here today. I obviously represent the appellant defendants, Officer Price and Beasley. Also with me here is a deputy and the Haywood County Sheriff's Attorney, David Weejay Wickerama, okay. And also an attorney as well, and the Haywood County Manager, Ira Dove.
Anybody else you want to introduce?
No, sir.
Okay.
As I do represent the individual defendants, and we are here today on the defendant's appeal of the order of District Judge Ridinger's denial of their motion for summary judgment. As the court knows, in pertinent part, the denial was based on the officer's assertion of qualified immunity related to and public officials' immunity related to the 1983 Fourth Amendment claim, as well as the related
Is your statement. Argument focused on no constitutional violation or no clearly established precedent for the action?
Both, Your Honor.
Okay.
And as you know, it's a two-part test. So we are focused, number first, that there was no constitutional violation under the Fourth Amendment because the officers had a reasonable belief, probable cause, to believe that Mr. Hensley, the decedent in this case.
You said probable cause.
To believe that
they have to have probable cause?
Under the Tennessee versus Gardner, they had to have objectionable reasonable belief that that Mr. Hensley posed a serious threat to them. And in this case, they used deadly force, as you know, in
but
response
to that's not probable cause, is it?
You're correct, Your Honor. Okay. It's an objectionable, reasonable standard as to whether they reasonably believe that they had that right to use.
And you're comfortable taking the facts in the light most favorable to the appellants? To the family.
Yes, Your Honor, we are. As under the qualified immunity scenario and why we're here and able to do this under the collateral doctrine is because we accept the facts as found by District Court Judge Ridinger, and we believe, and our contention is, even accepting those facts, there was still, as a matter of law, no violation.
Well, that includes there's no evidence that Mr. Hensley, ever pointed the weapon at any officer.
Yes, sir, and that's what the district court judge found, that he did not point
Well, you want to tell us what the facts are as you're operating on them then?
Yes, sir.
And just in summary?
Yes, sir. And the facts, the undisputed facts, are this, that on the early morning of August 9th, 2012, it was light. It was clearly visible to both the officers and the witnesses in this case, which are, of course, the decedent's two teenage daughters. On that morning, a 911 call.
But the proffer of evidence from both parties is starkly different.
Yes, sir.
So I'm not sure that it being light as opposed to dark is going to help you at this stage of the proceedings.
My point there, Your Honor, is this, that and I'll get to the facts in just a second, with regard to the ability of Mr. Hensley and the daughters to recognize that these were police officers fully in uniform in marked cars pulling into their
Didn't the girls say that?
Yes, sir.
Didn't the girls say that? So that's a fact.
They did.
At least the girls and somebody in their vantage point where the father was, they could tell they were police cars.
Yes, sir. And what the girls testified to is that the father and the girls were standing at the kitchen window when the two police cars came down the hill. And when they saw the two police cars coming down the hill towards their property, Mr. Hensley.
I don't know why you need all that.
Well, Mr. Hensley immediately.
All the operative facts that you have to accept this that the girls were involved in some kind of altercation, and I'm not using loaded words, some kind of altercation on the porch, that the father, Mr. Hensley, the decedent, had a pistol.
Yes, sir.
They were scrambling over that. The girls were screaming. He hit one of the girls in the back of the head a couple times with the pistol.
Yes, sir.
Then he turned, walked off the porch with the pistol, walked out in the yard, and walked briskly toward the police car.
That's right.
Other facts that are not disputed include that Officer Beasley, who was the first car there, he saw the weapon and immediately fell across his front seat in a defensive posture. The other officer, Mr. Price, he saw that Mr. Hensley was approaching the first police officer's car, Mr. Beasley, and thought, and that's the facts. And
yes,
all
sir.
This happened in about 13 seconds.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's
Those
correct.
Are the operative facts that you accept.
That's correct.
As I understood it, both the daughters testified that Mr. Hensley's arms were down by his side, that at no time did he, in fact, point the weapon, and I believe it is undisputed that at no point did the police officers say, drop the gun.
It is undisputed.
There was no verbal command to stop, drop the weapon, or any announcement of any kind before the firing began.
That's correct. There was no announcement by either Officer Beasley or Lieutenant Price prior to firing the weapon. It is, of course.
So with those, or if those are the facts, what's your clearly established law here?
So the clearly established law is this, Your Honor. Based on the assault that took place in the presence, in a violent assault that took
but
place.
But there were actions that took place. Are you talking about his hitting his daughter?
Yes, ma'am.
They didn't respond to that. Time elapsed between their observing that and Hensley stepping off the porch and walking in the direction. So the assault is out of the picture at the point of their response.
Well, it's similar to other cases, Your Honor, where there had been a crime that occurred in the presence of the officers. There knew, and it was a violent crime, and there knew.
Why does that matter to you in your assessment?
Because, Your Honor, it matters. Because
I didn't ask you if you thought it mattered. I said, why does it matter? Why?
It matters because the officers were in the presence of a violent crime, and it leads to their reasonable belief.
They saw a person who, within 13 seconds before they shot at him, assaulted somebody. He had assaultive criminal behavior.
And had a gun and had a weapon with him. And then as soon as he was completed the assault, and by the way, the timeline there is the 13 seconds are from when they call in gun until the shooting. So they call in gun before the assault occurs. But as soon as the assault occurred, Mr. Hensley walked down the stairs and directly towards Officer Beasley, who then was raising up.
All right,
and saw
so
him
at the time that the officers fired their weapon, what are the operative facts that you say authorize them to shoot?
Your Honor,
so far I haven't heard any.
The operative facts are this. Mr. Hensley was aware that they were police officers. As the court said in the Cooper case, someone who approaches...
Well, you have to draw the inference that he was aware, but let's assume that he did.
Well, I think that the facts are, I think the undisputed facts are that he was aware based on the testimony.
Let's assume that's right.
Assume he was aware, as this court has stated, someone who approaches a police officer knowing they're a police officer, and these are different from some of the cases that are the Pena case versus...
That's not going to win the day for you, the fact that he knew they were police officers. I don't know why you're starting there. That's not the key fact that's going to win this case for you, do you think?
I agree it's not the key factor, Your Honor.
Then I'm wondering why you're talking about
it. It's one of the factors, Your Honor, that leads the officers to... When somebody approaches officers, knowing they're officers, with a weapon, after committing a violent crime...
Whoa. What specifically, anywhere in here, is evidence of threatening behavior toward the police? Toward the police. What put the police in fear? Now, you have the daughters testifying that he turned... Hensley turned back and said, mouthed, I love you. And then at no time did my father raise his arm, either arm, or point a gun at anybody, including the police officers. He descended the stairs and walked at a normal pace. He was not acting aggressive and did not raise his arms or his hands from his side. So what put the officers in fear?
Your Honor, I think the fact, number one, of course, it is the officer's perception, similar to the Sigmund case.
No, the Sigmund case is so fact. Well, for one thing, in Sigmund, the officers, as I recall, said, stop, cease, drop your weapon. There was no verbal communication here between the officers. The officers said nothing. They didn't say anything in reaction to what we're now calling assaultive behavior on his daughter, who is not complaining of such. So all we had, the only evidence we have of a reaction, the explanation for reaction to the officers in the facts that the children have given, is that their father is walking toward the police with his hands down by his side at a normal pace, not behaving aggressively, and they open fire.
And he does have a weapon. So why don't you go to those facts and make your argument?
Yes, sir. He does have a weapon after committing a serious violent crime.
Is possession of a weapon enough?
Well, Your Honor, as
haven't
you know,
we held that possession of a weapon by itself is not sufficient?
Well, the Fourth Circuit has recently held in the U.S. versus Robinson case that you're right, not in and of itself. But
not in and of itself, and that was why. That was why I was focusing on behavior other than the weapon, since the weapon, the fact of the weapon by itself doesn't get you very far.
I agree. But as you know, in the U.S. versus Robbins case.
Why don't you make your argument under these operative facts while the officers didn't act unreasonably? Isn't that your position? You haven't made that argument yet.
Your Honor.
Make it with the facts of the case.
The facts being that the assault occurred. He's approaching the, and the officer.
Now this is
Price,
the assault on the daughter.
The daughter.
The daughter.
Do you make this line of argument in your brief?
I'm sorry?
Did you make this line of argument in the brief? Because I'm not remembering the assault on the daughter being part of the argument.
We did make it as being the criminal, this act, the criminal act that occurred in front of the officers, which would lead them to believe that Mr. Hensley is dangerous, he has a weapon, he's approaching Officer Beasley with that weapon, which would lead Officer Price, who arguably fired the first shot, to believe that he was in serious danger of either Beasley.
All right, let me read you this language. Maybe this will focus the argument. This is from our decision in Cooper versus Sheehan from 2013. An officer does not possess the unfettered authority to shoot a member of the public simply because the officer is carrying a weapon. Instead, deadly force may only be used by a police officer when, based on a reasonable assessment, the officer or another person is threatened, present tense, with the weapon. So, at the point they fired their weapons, what's the threat that authorizes them to shoot?
The threat is in their mind. They've just witnessed this assault.
What is the threat to them?
That following the assault, which leads them, a reasonable person, to believe that Mr. Hensley is dangerous and has used the weapon as part of the assault, he then approaches the officer with the weapon and the officers fire. So that is the threat. That is the threat to the officer.
So it's the possession of the gun and the previous assault against someone else.
It's the totality of the circumstances, the possession of the gun, the walking towards the officer.
And that
officer
is what is threatening to the officers, because it has to be a threat to the officers.
Yes, ma'am. The fact that he had just committed a violent crime which they observed, would lead a reasonable person to believe, a reasonable officer to believe, that as he commits the crime and then approaches the officer with a gun, that would lead to have a reasonable belief that he has.
Do the Hensleys agree that his hitting the girl on the back of the head was a violent crime?
I don't know that the Hensleys agree or disagree to that, but mm-hmm. they certainly
they acknowledge that he struck the girl on the back of the head
at least one time while the other daughter was attempting to stop him from doing that.
Right, and then he stopped and walked down the steps.
He did.
Let's start. Take the facts as we have them here and add a few other variables to see how the principle you're describing adds up. So after he hits his daughter with the weapon, the decedent doesn't leave the steps right then, stays on the porch for 2 minutes. Then he comes down the steps exactly the same way it's recounted in the facts. So it's not a 13-second interval. It's a 2-minute interval. Does that change your argument?
I think that may change the argument, Your Honor, in that it gives the officers more time to make a determination as to what is going on and to assess the situation, and
what's changed? He's still assaulted his daughter with a pistol. He's still got the pistol in his hand. He's still walking toward them. They haven't given him a warning of any kind. How does that make a difference?
Well, if they haven't given him a warning and haven't gone through those things, and of course there's no case that says you have to give a warning
in the difference that in 13 seconds is one continuous action?
It is.
If that's the difference, why don't you answer that question?
It is the difference, Your Honor.
Well, answer his question. That's what he asked you.
I think, and that is the point I was trying to make, though, is that he's up there. They have a larger opportunity to assess the situation, give warnings if appropriate, and do that sort of thing. This is a rapidly evolving situation.
I mean, the point, what I'm not getting is the focus keeps shifting from behavior that is threatening to the police to an act involving hitting the child on the back of the head, to which the officers wasn't directed at the officers, and was followed by he stops, he turns, he comes down the steps, hands toward his side, and they open fire. So the only behavior at that point is the possession of the weapon. That's all they have before they open fire. No stop, no drop the weapon, no pointing of the weapon, no immediate threat, which I think you would have to concede.
My time is up. May I answer your
question? You can answer that question.
Yes, sir. The immediate threat, I mean, this is a very quick, short
the
situation.
The immediate threat to them is
these officers in their mind, looking at what they're thinking and what they've seen and what they believe, is that he had just committed this assault, which leads one to believe that he's dangerous, and he then approaches the officer with the gun in his hand still.
And do you have any authority for the proposition that alone, that the possession of the weapon, having witnessed, for the sake of argument, violent assault, is a threat deserving of the response of deadly force?
I think many of the cases that we've cited, the Slattery case, the Anderson case, those cases are similar in that in those cases, a lot of times there wasn't a gun or they didn't even see anything, but those were the imminent threat, or at least their perception that there was an imminent threat.
When you come back up for rebuttal, why don't you give us your absolute best case that you think is the closest to this?
Thank you, Your
Honor. All right, thank you very much. Mr. McClain.
Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is Russell McClain. I'm an attorney from Haywood County, North Carolina, and I represent the appellees in this matter. Teresa Hensley is the administrator of the estate of David Hensley and the two daughters, Rachel Ferguson, and now that she's an adult, I'll call her Haley.
We got who you represent.
Yes,
you want to go ahead and make your argument?
May it please the Court, this Court has a standard that it employs for purposes of summary judgment. And this is what this case is about.
We've already laid the facts out as we are to consider in this case, haven't we?
You have, with some exceptions that I'll highlight in my argument, the qualified immunity argument of counsel does not override ordinary rules applicable to summary judgment proceedings. And this Court has quoted...
What I think Judge Shedd might be suggesting is that we've demonstrated an awareness of the facts, and I think... The critical point here is that we have to take the facts in the light that is given to us by the Hensley family. So with that, can you help me?
Yes, ma'am.
What is it? I still am trying to find out what the immediate threat was to the officers.
That's what is in dispute. Those officers both claimed that as my client's husband walked across the yard, that he pointed the pistol
directly
at the officer with his right hand.
They don't get those facts at this hearing. They don't get those facts. Those facts are off the table.
That's correct.
Although they did testify that he raised his arm, pointed the gun at Beasley twice.
That's correct.
And there is, in all fairness, some real slippage in the brief between how the facts are portrayed in the light most favorable to whom?
And in our opinion, the light portrays the light most favorable to the plaintiff is that he never raised his arm. He wasn't
right. He didn't raise his arm.
And 13 seconds expired from the time that he had hit his daughter in the head with the gun on the porch. 13 seconds passed in which the officers did nothing. They didn't speak to him. They didn't tell him to put a gun down. They didn't tell him to drop the gun to hit the ground. My clients.
Do you think they're constitutionally required to do that?
I think.
You got a case that says that?
Basically, what it says is that you.
No,
judge,
I ask you.
Yes, sir. I have.
There's
a case.
There's no constitutional requirement that an officer, as an absolute, warn somebody before he fires.
People do have a constitutional right not to be subjected to deadly force.
That's
under
correct.
Certain circumstances, and I think we're pretty clear about that.
What the cases in the line of cases out of the Fourth Circuit and United States Supreme Court take the position is that you do not. You have to judge the decision of the officers at the moment that they squeeze the trigger.
I didn't ask you that. My question was, and I'm pretty sure I know the answer to it, there's no case that says there's a constitutional requirement that in any and all circumstances an officer has to warn before he fires.
You're exactly right, sir. Right. There is not a case.
That doesn't mean you lose this case, but let's just establish.
What it says is you take the circumstances in its totality at that moment. Right. At the time he squeezes the trigger.
And we've laid those out,
you
I
have.
Think.
You
Let's
have.
Just refresh them to see. You suggested we didn't have them correct, or you wanted to add something.
No, I didn't mean to do that.
Okay.
I apologize.
This is this, that the officers saw a struggle on the porch between two women. It turned out to be the daughter.
That's correct.
And Mr. Hensley. He then struck one of them at least once or maybe several twice. Times in the back of the head. He then turned, walked with the gun in his hand to the edge of the porch, off the porch, out into the yard, and then angled toward the police car.
That's correct.
And all that occurred in 13 seconds.
What
facts don't we have?
You did a pretty good job of recounting.
And they were on, but they were, I think it's also fair to say, or to point out, that they were on, as I recall, his property.
That's correct. They were on his property. They had never known this man. They didn't know a thing about him. From that day, if you look at Mr. Price's statement, or Officer Price's statement, at 650 or 45 of the second appendage, he had no knowledge of this man.
What
until the
does it factor in your case that they owned his property? The police had been called to the property.
They had.
For purposes of my question, and in fairness, I raised it. He's just responding to my question. Is I'm still struggling with the fact that. What we're dealing with is a person who is simply possessing a gun on his own property.
I'm a Second Amendment advocate. I'll just tell you straight up, I carry a gun around my property quite a bit. I've got a pretty big tract of land.
The opposing counsel's argument, as I understand it, is that accepting all those facts and the light most favorable to you, that was sufficient under our case law to constitute an immediate threat to the officers so that they were justified in firing. That's his argument as I understand it.
Yes, sir.
So I think your task is to tell us why that's wrong. We don't need to talk about the facts anymore. Just tell us why that's wrong.
It's wrong because it has to be judged from the totality of the circumstances at the moment they executed the trigger pull. If that man had been pointing a pistol at me, I probably shot him too, but that's not in dispute. At least that's in dispute, but at least right. Our position is he didn't point the gun, and if he didn't point the gun, then they didn't have the right to exercise that deadly force because he was not a threat. Because if you look at our expert, Marvin Tucker, who is probably
Let me ask this, but you don't think the law is, in any and all circumstances, officers can't shoot unless a gun's pointed at them?
Oh, absolutely.
You don't think
I
that.
Do not.
You just think under these facts, and that's what you've been asked,
that's
to
fine.
Make the point under these facts, basically comes down to constitutional violation, that the officer's actions were unreasonable.
They were unreasonable based on our expert opinion, Marvin Tucker, who's a nationally known expert. He said the carrying of a weapon in and of itself.
I don't really think that the expert informs us on what the law is.
I understand he doesn't, but his position is, as he's trained officers, he is only a potential threat. And it's the moment that he points the gun at somebody makes him an actual threat. And if he didn't point the gun, he's not an actual threat, and therefore that is a Fourth Amendment violation.
Oh, wait.
What's your best case for that proposition?
My best case for which proposition?
For the immediacy of the threat at the moment. I think you were beginning.
I was looking at the couple of the cases that I had cited in my brief that stands for the proposition that it is the only opportunity to have a actual threat when the gun is pointed, but it's also you take it in the context of the totality of the circumstances, which is a standard that this court uses all the time. You have to look at all of the facts to make the totality of the circumstances for the decision that that officer made at the moment.
Right,
that he squeezed the trigger.
I think we asked counsel for the officers as well. I'm particularly focused on the immediate, I guess you can tell from our questions,
yes,
on the immediacy of the threat to which deadly force is applied.
All we have is that the man didn't point the gun, therefore you...
If you sort of let me finish my question, you might be able to answer it better. I was interested for authority on that question.
What's your best case?
My best case is the case that I suggest to Your Honor that Judge Ridinger wrote in his opinion, which is basically that...
Well, that's not exactly precedent, is
right.
it?
It's not precedent, but he cited some
case.
What's your best case that matters?
my best case that matters. I like that question, Judge.
I'm sure Judge Shedd is thrilled that you like this question.
I'm sure he is, too, Your Honor.
I know if I kept asking him sooner or later, you'd like one of them.
That's correct. And basically, I think it's the case that...
Are you familiar with our decision in Cooper versus Sheehan?
I am, Your Honor.
Did you cite that in your brief?
Actually, I didn't, as I remember. I didn't cite that in the brief. But
You said you did or you didn't?
I did not. I didn't cite it.
I was wondering about that, actually.
Well, and truthfully...
How about that be your best case, maybe?
That might be a good case, and I'd like to suggest that case to this court.
We'll send you a bill afterwards.
That's fine, Your Honor, and I appreciate that. But
Because Judge Agee pointed out to some very useful language. The police approach a residence and tap on a window. Cooper grabs a shotgun, steps onto the porch with the butt of the firearm in his right hand and the muzzle pointed toward the ground.
I brought that case, Your Honor, just in case you were going to ask me about it.
You just didn't cite it?
I just didn't cite it.
Okay. That would seem to me a fairly useful case. We held that the officers could not, on those facts, reasonably believed that he posed a deadly threat sufficient to commence firing without warning.
And that's why I was going to suggest to Your Honor that while it wasn't in my brief, I did bring the Cooper case to offer that as some supportive case law.
I just want to be sure that I'm thinking there's no evidence in this case that we often have in cases of this type where there will be expert witnesses for both sides that will come in and they will say officers are trained that at such and such a distance, depending on what the weapon is, that's the point of no return, and they have to fire at that distance because if they don't, then they're subject to assault. You don't have any evidence like that.
That's right. I think that's what I call the 21-foot rule, I believe.
You don't have any of that in this case at this point.
And I think if you look, the deceased was probably as equal distance from the girls as he was from the officer.
Right, but we don't have any evidence about what that was.
No. Okay. No.
We don't have any evidence from the experts. We have evidence of what the distance was.
We do have evidence of the distance, which was about equal distance from the porch to the car.
Why should both of these officers be judged under the same standard?
Because both of them said they pulled the trigger. Both of them claim they're the ones that killed
them. No, but weren't they in different positions?
They were.
Absolutely. As far as threat to them and why they fired?
One was 15. He said 15 yards. I think he meant 15.
I'm not talking about just distance, but I'm talking about what the officer's perspective, I don't mean his perspective on the facts, but his position and perspective on why he fired, don't they both justify their firing for two different reasons?
If you believe the evidence, as they've said.
But it's not disputed.
It's not disputed.
We have to believe it at this point.
Yes, sir. One officer said that he was walking toward Beasley's car, and Price said he's the one that shot him. Beasley said he jumped out of the car and
pulled. No, but the difference is, what was Beasley's position before the shots were fired?
He was in the car.
He was more than in the car.
He was late.
And he saw the pistol.
He did.
He immediately took a defensive position by laying down across the front seat, correct?
If you believe Beasley.
Well, you have to believe him. Well, there any conflicting testimony?
Yes, sir, there is. The two girls said their daddy never pointed the gun at them.
I didn't say he pointed a gun.
Oh,
I said he saw the gun.
Beasley estimated that Hensley was approximately 45 feet from him when Beasley started firing. Was he in the car when he fired?
Beasley actually kicked the door open, rolled out of the car, slid down the car, fired the first shot in the ground, according to Beasley.
Mm-hmm.
Said the third shot's what dropped him. Price said he dropped him on his second shot.
It wasn't Beasley. Isn't this the truth? Beasley was scared to death.
Both of them were, Judge.
Beasley was scared to death. He was in his car. When you look at the pictures, Mr. Hensley was approaching toward Beasley's driver's door.
That's correct.
Beasley had dropped in the car, quite frankly. Only inference is he was scared to death.
Yeah.
If you see what he says he was.
Sure.
He didn't even look up much.
He didn't.
He then pushed the door open, and quite frankly, he got out to take off running.
I call it rolling out, is what I think.
Right.
That's what he said.
But that's his perspective, right. And on why he fired. He was really running away shooting,
sure.
I think. The other officer's in a slightly different position. And his position is, this is Price. Price sees that Officer Beasley has dropped into a defensive position.
Actually, Price said he never could see Beasley. And only if you remember, he said his vision got focused, he got narrowed, and he didn't even see Beasley. And then when you know, after Price says he fired his second shot, he picked up his radio, put it up.
Well, just let me say this.
Yes, sir, I'm sorry.
Then Price, I'm not sure about that one fact, yeah. If you saw him lean over before he went to tunnel vision on that weapon.
Right.
That Hensley was carrying. But Price saw somebody with a weapon who he had just seen assault somebody approaching his partner. Door, driver's door.
That's correct.
That's why he fired, isn't it? His
yes,
justification
sir. That's
to
exactly
protect.
What he said.
Why aren't those two officers assessed and adjudged in whether or not their actions are reasonable differently?
Because I suggest that Price had no greater right to shoot him than Beasley did. That's what I'm suggesting to this court. In other words,
I understand your position. It didn't necessarily your argument that should be assessed differently. I'm going to ask the other side too.
Sure.
Why everybody seems to lump those officers together, and it seems to me there's a very good belief that maybe they ought to be assessed differently. One, is he justified in mortal fear that he's going to be shot? The other is he justified in shooting in this 13 seconds to protect a partner who has somebody with a gun approaching his driver's door?
Because I don't believe that Beasley shot him. If you listen to the tape, you still hear, you hear Price on the radio after he said he hit the ground, fell face down, he picked up the radio, called dispatch, said shots fired, need help. You can still hear shots being fired in the background while Price was claiming that he was laying dead on the ground. So you can actually hear the gunshots on the
transcript. What does that mean?
Beasley missed. Okay, he shot the house up. He assaulted the girls.
Beasley did.
Beasley missed, assaulted the girls.
I don't know if we can have that as a find of fact.
Well,
but it strikes me that's a pretty fair reading of the facts. I think Beasley got trapped in that car. The guy came after him with a weapon. He scrambled out of that car, and I think he was running away for fear of his life, shooting.
Yeah.
I think that's what happened.
And if you look at the photographs of the SBI, that gun was never anywhere except in my client's left hand. He was laying on the ground dead when he rolled him over. These officers never.
But he had the weapon.
He had a weapon. That's all he had, was a weapon. The other thing that I would like to sum up real quick on the state claims, apparently the judge tied all of the state claims to the immunity issue. I suggest under your case of Myers that even if you find that they are entitled to immunity, the state charges claims still go forward because you still hear Beasley shooting while Price says that Hensley's on the ground.
What
dead.
About that? If in fact he is, if either there was no constitutional violation, there was not unreasonable seizure, or if he's entitled under qualified immunity because there's no clear law, How does that impact on the state claims?
It shouldn't, because you still have Beasley creating, shooting at the girls.
This is your assault claim.
What about the intention and infliction of emotional distress?
I think it's negligent. I lost the claim on intentional because I think the judge was right in that. I think it's an intention. It's a negligent claim under state law, and it's a.
But you think even if they were justified to shoot, that you still would have a claim that in their justification to shoot,
yes,
they still could have a state tort against him?
Yes, sir, I do. And I may be wrong on that, but that's my position. And I think the, you know, kind of supports the claim because Beasley.
Well, I figured that'd be your position.
Yeah. Well, particularly,
but I was just asking if you have
particularly
any support
where,
for that.
When the threat had ended, and you still hear gunshots at the girls. That's the critical distinction, and I think that's the thing that makes it survive. If that makes sense, I'm supposed to sum up, so I will sum up and say that I believe that Judge Reitinger was correct, and that there's material issues, facts sufficient to allow this case to go before the jury. That when the cases are in dispute, if the jury could find for the plaintiff from the set of facts as outlined, then the case should be affirmed and the matter remanded to the district court for a trial on the merits, and we would let the fact finders make those determinations. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. McClain. Mr. Flanagan, you have 5 minutes, and I think you have some questions they've asked you to be prepared to answer.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Agee, I think that the question was, what is the best case? And I think the cases we cited in our brief are all similar to these.
But you're going to tell us what number one is.
Yes, sir. I think the Anderson versus Russell case that we cited is perhaps number one. I think, though, that also...
Well, why?
It would help me specifically if in those cases the officers didn't order. The problem is that in the cases that I recall in your brief, all of the officers ordered the person that they are saying is threatening to drop their weapon or stop. Yeah. So if you have any cases where you don't have that, that would help me.
There's not any cases I'm aware of that say that specifically.
Right.
But I will say this.
I'm not arguing the point. I was just asking for a slightly finer focus on the authority from my perspective. That's all.
Yes,
I didn't
ma'am. And
as
you pointed out, of course, they don't. There's no requirement they have to. And I think that's the key point here under the qualified immunity scenario as well, is there's not a case that's right on point with this specific facts of the case.
Could I ask, that's sort of why you have juries if there is, taking the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, a fact finder could find that the defendants used excessive force. And it doesn't get them home. It just gets them to a jury. It gets them past the qualified immunity defense.
Well, I think if they find that there was a violation that occurred, that's step one. But the plaintiffs have to prove two steps under the qualified immunity scenario, and that is that it was clearly established that it did violate their constitutional right at the time this occurred.
Well, they have a right not to be subjected to excessive force, deadly force. We can't be arguing about that.
Absolutely not.
Okay.
About that anyway.
So for purposes of my articulation of the standard, you would have to say, would you not, that no reasonable fact finder, taking the facts in the light most favorable to Hensley, could determine that the defendants used excessive force?
I think under the qualified immunity standard, under step two, what has to be shown, what the plaintiffs have to show, is that there was a case that's almost beyond debate, similar to this one, with the factual scenarios were the same.
Qualified immunity is a question of law.
Correct.
So what we're focusing on now is, for purposes of answering that question of law, we have to accept the facts, which you do in summary judgment, in the light most favorable to the Hensleys. Correct?
I agree.
Okay.
And
so what we have to be able to show is, to apply the qualified immunity protection, you have to be able to find that those facts would not allow a reasonable fact finder to conclude that the officers used excessive force. That's actually kind of a sort of a black letter statement of law.
But
I don't think you could.
Which is a legal issue for this panel. panel to decide.
Not the factual issue. I agree. That's all I'm saying.
I agree. Not the factual issue. Yes, we're.
You have to. Your argument has to be. I take it you're trying to make it is. First of all, qualified immunity never goes to the jury, does it?
It does not.
Qualified immunity is a right that some people have in some circumstances not to go to the jury.
Right.
So on the facts, as you argue them, and here we've already established, I hope we have, what we have in front of us, you have to argue either that this was not a constitutional violation because the officers did not act unreasonably under the circumstances, or you have to show what they did under the circumstance does not clearly violate some established law. You would say, I take it, that the fact you can't use excessive force, as the Supreme Court says, that's too generalized a concept.
That's right.
Do you want to argue? How do you make your argument in light of all that?
Because
make your argument.
Again, Your Honor, under that White v. Pauley case, the Supreme Court case that came out this year, that's exactly what they said, that there has to be a specific case under very similar facts, beyond debate, that says that it was clearly established that they did violate.
No, because that leaves out the factual component. You're in the context of summary judgment. You have to deal with the factual underpinnings. The right, you're right that you can't define the right at a high level of generality, but excessive force can only be determined on the basis of a set of facts. But the facts themselves don't have to be identical to a precedent.
Well,
do they?
May I make
you an answer?
The situation, yes, they do. They have to be. They don't have to be identical, but they have to be extremely similar beyond debate, as the Supreme Court said.
No, that's not the part that has to be beyond debate.
They have to be. It has to be the same scenario. So, if these officers are confronted with the same or very very similar facts as other officers.
Right.
There has to be clearly established that those facts, under those facts, it established it violated a, in this case.
Is that an argument you made in your brief?
And do you have any authority for it?
Well, tell us first. Did you make the argument in your brief that you just made in the last minute?
We supplemented it with the White versus Pauley case, of course, but we made the argument.
Well, that's not. The Supreme Court didn't really make new law there because they've kind of been plowing the same furrow for a long time. But I don't recall you making this argument in your brief or before the district court. So you tell us if I'm wrong.
That under these, yes, we did, Your Honor. In fact, we argued that this was more similar to the Sigma case and less and not similar to the Pena versus Porter case, which is what the plaintiffs were arguing.
Well, the point in the Supreme Court case, as I'm understanding it, is that a trial court errs if they analyze the qualified immunity issue at too general a level. And it needs to be more granular, not less granular. I don't recall seeing that argument in your brief.
I don't think it was specifically made in the brief under those terms. And did I answer your question?
I think we're done.
Thank you
very much. And let me say, follow the procedures we use at the Fourth Circuit. We'll now step down and greet the lawyers and thank them for the advocacy in the case. I'll go straight on to the next one.
Sure.